Okay, so I called my talk Plan 9, The Better Unix. And it's actually, I actually jumped in to give this talk now because somebody got sick. And it's a talk I'd given before somewhere else, so it's recycled in a way. And I didn't have much time to prepare it, but I think it'll be fine. So I'm going to start with some slides, and then we later see the system in action. So Plan 9 was meant to be the successor to Unix, and it was developed at Bell Labs by mostly the same people who also did Unix. And you can think of it as pretty much Unix plus graphics and network and some improvements like the lessons learned. It was written by mostly Rob Pike and Ken Thompson, who they did the initial basic system and concepts, and then other people like Dave Presotto, Howard Trickey, Phil Winterbottom, and others fleshed out the system and implemented various aspects of it. They started in the 1980s, and by 1992, the first edition was released to universities. Then 3 years later, the second edition was released to a more, to a wider public, but it was you couldn't use it commercially. Then in 2000, it was released under the third edition was released under some pseudo open source license, which was not quite what people were happy with. And then 2002, the fourth edition was released under the Lucent Public License, which was a free license but still incompatible with GPL, and people were still not quite happy with that either. And that was the last release from Bell Labs. And people started, because the was not really developed further after that point, at least not so much. So people started forking it or putting in their own improvements, and there were some projects. Nine Atom is no longer doesn't exist anymore, I think. Nine Front is still going, and this is like the main place where Plan 9 development still happens, I think. And Nine Legacy is like a set of patches on top of the original Bell Labs Plan 9. To sort of keep the original system running. And then only 2021, the Plan 9 Foundation was founded, and the whole code was relicensed under MIT license. Okay, so we start with Unix. The user interface on a Unix system was originally a teletype, like you can see here. And there was a very neat hack in the kernel, because Unix had this concept of everything as a file, and particular devices are represented as files. So there was a file, devtty, which always refers to the current teletype that one is working on. And this was a hack in the kernel. The kernel knows which tty a process runs on, like which one it's attached to. And it gives this file, devtty, a different meaning depending on which process is opening the file or reading the file or whatever. So you can see there is devtty 0 and 1, and these are absolute names, so to speak. They refer to one concrete teletype. But devtty always refers to the current one. So if Dennis here sits down next to Ken, then he will also have a devtty, but it's a different one. But that was pretty much a hack in the kernel. It was a nice idea, though. In the late, maybe in the early 80s, graphics started to happen, and Rob Pike and Bart Locanthi built this Blit terminal, which you can see a photo of here. And it was like a teletype, but graphical, of course, with the keyboard and mouse and the screen. But it was still a terminal, which connected to a Unix machine. The user interface was inspired by Smalltalk and the PERC computer, but the PERC was a workstation. And they took this name Perk, and because they were not very happy with it, they called their version the Jerk. But that was not commercially viable, so when AT&T decided to make a product out of it, they call it the Blit. After the BitBlit operation to put pixels on a screen. So this was a terminal, not a workstation. It had to connect to a Unix system to do anything useful. But still, it needed a small, tiny operating system on that Blit to do like the Windows and the terminal emulation, so to speak. It's not a terminal emulator like we use now, which are essentially like VT100s. These are just windows with text, pretty much, not proper terminals. And it was connected to Unix machine, and this Unix then needed some kind of pseudo TTY files, like we also have with SSH now or something. But previously that didn't exist because you just had the hard copy terminal or a video terminal. And the essential idea of this system was that every window, like you have one screen and one mouse and one keyboard, but if you have windows on that screen, you kind of it's like you're multiplexing these things, and every window just gets its own view of the mouse and its own view of the keyboard. Like when I'm in a different window and I type something, the other windows don't see that. And pretty much everything has the same view of the system. They all have a screen, which is their own window, and a keyboard, which is the keys that they get when the window is active, and similar with a mouse. And I could show a demo of this, but I don't know, maybe later, depends on the time. So that was like a very basic operating system. And you still have this distinction between Unix and the terminal. So Rob Pike started writing. Well, first of all, they built a second machine, the Knot, and it's like an iteration on the Blit design. It's a bit more powerful and so on. And Rob Pike experimented with an operating system for that machine, and there were two main ideas. The first one is that in Unix, you have this file tree, which looks the same for everyone. Like you go from the root directory and then directory slash directory and so on. The new idea was that every process could have its own view of the file system. So, for instance, the reason that the mount system call in Unix needs root permissions is because it changes the global state of things for everyone. And Plan 9, mount is not a privileged thing. Everyone can do it because they only change their own view of the system. And also the file system is not made up of like these persistent files on disk or device files, but anything that looks like a file, pretty much. And the kernel can mount different file servers to different parts in the file tree and build up their view, their namespace, like that. And the kernel needs some file servers built in, like for the hardware, for a mouse, for a screen, for maybe a serial or a network connection. And that's it. And that's enough to talk to a Unix system, for instance. In this early time, it was a Unix system, to mount like files on disk, like a Unix file server, like source code, binaries, and so on. But at this point, it was still two different systems again. Some of the, like this dev TTY hack was kind of, like the idea was nice, but it was changed. First of all, it's split up now because we have graphics. So dev cons is pretty much the keyboard, dev mouse is the mouse, and BitBlit is BitBlit and Windows for the graphics. But now the important difference is that previously we had devtty, which was a single file which looked differently depending on the process, but devcons is always a different file, but it always has the same name. So so a program just opens devcons and reads from the keyboard, but it could be the real keyboard, like the hardware keyboard, or it could be the multiplexed keyboard that's connected to a single window only. And the power of the namespace allows for for different files to have the same name. And that system evolved and became Plan 9. And by 1990, they were able to use it like for productive use. They had the NOT terminals built from 68K CPUs. CPU servers, which ran proper programs like compilers and everything. And that was SGI MIPS based at the time. And the file server was originally on a different machine, on a Unix machine, still running on a VAX. And they have they had the Windows system 8.5, named after the movie, the SAM text editor, which was also graphical, still is, a new shell, the RC shell, which is also still the shell in Plan 9 today, and a new C compiler and C library, and some kind of POSIX compatibility layer, APE. And later it was ported to more hardware like Intel, Spark, PowerPC Alpha, and so on. And the file server still remained a separate thing early on, like a separate kernel, but it became a user space program later. So now let's take a look at the system calls. These are around 40 syscalls compared to Linux with 450 and Windows NT 4 with around 200 and then 500 more for the graphic stuff that went into the kernel at some point. This is pretty minimal. And we have pretty much, well, standard system calls to deal with processes, with memory, with a file system, files, nodes, which is the Plan 9 equivalent to signals, and semaphores, which were actually added later, if I'm not mistaken, for a synchronization. Rendezvous is the preferred way, I think, to do synchronization stuff. And notice there are pretty much two... do I have a slide for this? Yeah, notice there is no ioctls, so, and also no sockets or network, no graphics. This is all done through the file system. The main differences to Unix, like these are almost what you would expect from a standard Unix system, but there are a few differences. Rfork is the first one. Unix has fork, and Rfork is more powerful, as we will see. And there is bind, which is new, and mound has some changed semantics, but it's pretty much these three that are the difference. So bind takes one file. Or one name. As I explain, I don't know why it's called old, but you take a name that exists already on the system, and you give it a new name, and then it's also available under that name. And with a flag, you have an order, like you can mount before, you can bind before, or you can bind after, because you can mount multiple things to the same name. And this is useful, for instance, for having binaries in different directories. And Unix has this path variable in the shell for this, and it will look up every directory and until it finds the binary. And in Plan 9, you can just use the file system for it. You just bind all the locations that you have your binaries in, you bind them under /bin, and then everything is visible under /bin, and you don't need any path variable anymore. And this is called the union bind, because you see everything that you bound to this location. this is what bind does. Something fun you can do in a sec. Something fun you can do is if you have a different system mounted over the network, or well, you have access to the file system of a different machine, you can use that /net directory of the other machine and bind it over your own /net, and then you're using the network of that other machine. It's sort of like a VPN, and it's just one line in plan 9, like a shell command, and you get some really fancy stuff. Do you have a question? I'm not. Yeah, if that's like an empty file or something, then you can hide it, yes. And mount, it sort of works like Unix mount, where you give a device file to it, and then you mount it into some directory. But in this case, it's not a device file, but it's a file descriptor that speaks the 9P protocol, which is the file protocol that's like is spread all over Plan 9. And you can do authentication as well over the A file descriptor, but that's not so interesting for us right now, I think. So one example is you mount Rio, which is the Windows system. There is a file that it serves, which speaks 9P, and you can mount that server under, for instance, mount foo, and you give it an argument, that's the A name in the call. And if that's new, it will create a new window. And you will have it available under mount foo, so a window has multiple files. We'll see that later. Actually, I think we can just try it out now. So we have, this is just the normal way to make a window, and we can go to here, and let's say mount serve mount foo new, and here I have my window. And now if I go to mount foo, I see all the files that are associated with that window, and now I can say something like hello VCFB, and it will display in the window. And if I mount this I'm not going to experiment now, but I could like take over the window. I just start a shell which connects its standard input and output to this cons file of that new window, and it will run in that window. Okay, so the idea is bind copies something to another place, something that already exists. Mount adds something new to the namespace, and unmount removes that. And I can check all the, I can check how my namespace was constructed with the ns command, which is like lsps, and this is ns. So you can see where is it? So these hash thingies are kernel devices, so the kernel knows about those directly. So hash c is the device directory, and hash d is for file descriptors and so on. And these have pretty fancy characters in some cases. C is the cons the device. So this is like the keyboard, and we can actually just take a look at what hash C is. So this is what hash C gives us. And if I check out the whole, I get more. And also notice that because it's a union mount, the same name appears multiple times, but you only get the last one, the latest one. You can't access the previous ones. And that's why there are these before and after arguments, so you can control in which order your namespace is constructed. Okay, now let's check out our fork. So in Unix, fork just copies the process completely with all resources like file descriptors, and it just creates a new process. And our fork is allows for more granularity. So what's called a so you can give it flags what to fork. So you can fork a process, and this is what would normally be called a thread. So it's a different thread of execution. You can also fork memory. This would turn a thread in the same program and give it a different memory map. So it this would split the process, like split the threads into what would be called processes in normal using normal usual terms. You can fork the namespace, so processes can share namespaces, or they can be in separate namespaces. Environment for environment variables, nodes, as I said, like signals in Unix, and they will be in different signal groups and so on, file descriptors and rendezvous groups as well. So these are more Plan 9 specific. But this process and memory thing is more general than what you have like in Mach or in T, where you have just this distinction between threads and processes. In Plan 9, this is all kind of the same thing, and you just give fork different different flags what to fork. So this is pretty powerful. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I don't think it's about resource usage. I wouldn't say that. Yeah, I think it's just it's like reflecting on fork. Okay, what does fork do? It forks a process, and I get two processes. But I have more stuff that maybe I want to keep some part of it, and maybe I want to split, like fork another part. And this is just an implementation of that. I don't think it's necessarily about resource usage or anything like that. So the way that 9P works is we have like these pretty much equivalents to the standard Unix system calls for files, like walk, for instance, walks down a file tree and opens a file, create creates a file, and so on. And these are just these are functions that every device in the kernel has to implement to work as a file server. And there is one device called devmount, and in this device translates these function calls in the kernel to RPCs, so to the 9P protocol, so you can speak it over files, over a network, and so on. And this is what allows the kernel to mount any program that speaks that 9P protocol into a namespace. Like, you can mount it from the kernel. The kernel is the client of that 9P server. Yeah, and 9P just has an equivalent for pretty much each of these. It's not an exact match, I think, but it's pretty close. And there is a T and R version of everything. So you have a request and then a reply to everything, except for error. There's only you can't request an error; just reply with an error. And there is a library written in C, lib9p, where you take these messages, the encoded version of that RPC, and it turns it back into functions, so you have a nice interface you can use with it. These are some of the file servers that the kernel provides, and I picked a really bad font because L, pipe, and I look almost identical. but yeah, so. You have the IP, for instance. You can see that here. All the network stuff is here. So you have Ethernet. That was the hash L thing. L stands for LANs, by the way. And you have TCP. And to open a network connection, you would just open this clone file, and then you get one of these. So every one of these directories here with the numbers represents one network, one TCP connection. So you open the clone file, and we'll create a new directory, like not literally create a directory on disk, but it's visible in the file tree as a directory. And then you write some connection message to the file that you get, and then it will, or you listen or whatever, like TCP connection stuff. And then you get a file, and you can read and write it, and it's just looks like a file, but it's a network connection. The /proc file system, for instance, is also one that was. It was not Plan 9 wasn't the first. Unix, some version of Unix at Bell Labs also had it, and Linux actually. I don't know if Linux took it from Unix or from Plan 9. I suspect from Plan 9, but I can like go to some process, and I will have all sorts of files to deal with it. But this should be mostly familiar from Linux actually, because that part of Linux was inspired by Plan 9. So I already gave a quick overview of the versions, but also like a little change log maybe. So the second edition introduced a new text editor that is actually kind of popular now. Not super popular, but Acme, and it's inspired by Oberon actually. So first of all, the user interface is very mouse driven on Plan 9. This was because it's inspired by Smalltalk and the Blit, and it hasn't really changed much since the Blit days in the 80s. It still behaves quite similar. But I have a file listing here, and if I do a right click on this directory, it will just open this directory and give me the there is some feeping noise here. It's really irritating. We'll open the directory and show me the files. So I don't know. I have some PDP 11 emulator here, and then I can open some file. I don't know. And with the middle mouse button, I can drag panes around, and I can scroll. And the text you see up here is to control the window. So if I middle click on Dell, for instance, it will delete. But the text is not some hard-coded button. But if I can write Dell anywhere, and I can write my own Dell and then click that, and it works too. And I can write new here, and I get a new window. So that's kind of neat. And it has a lot of funny features, and it's definitely worth checking that out. It's quite interesting as an editor. So that was new in the second edition. Acid is the debugger. The third edition redid the whole graphics part, actually. The original one was still inspired by the Blit, and it was only a bitmap graphics, black and white. And for the third edition, they redid the whole thing, first of all in color. And the semantics changed quite a bit as well. I don't know if I can get into that, but I don't think I have anything about that. But the old Windows system essentially re-implemented this drawing file completely. Like it, how do you explain that? It's quite hard. So the BitBlit protocol was used to draw on the screen, and the Windows system implemented that whole BitBlit protocol just for a single window. So the program running in the window has absolutely no idea that it's not running full screen. It just sees dev BitBlit and uses that to draw pixels. But the Windows system had to re-implement that whole protocol for every window. And because you can do things recursively, like I can run Rio in this window and I get a new Windows system, and I can hide this and so on. Because that was kind of inefficient, DevDraw actually handles the window multiplexing, and the And the Windows system kind of manages these. So the neat, transparent way the Windows system worked was given up to some degree for efficiency. But it's still nice enough. The plumber is very interesting as well. So let's see. Actually, let's kill that. Oops, that was the big Windows system. Sorry, gonna re-log in again. The exit button didn't used to be there. It's new. It takes a while because it's like over the network. It binds my own my local directory. Actually, that's something I can show. So DrawTerm is a program that's quite interesting. Because it provides these kernel files. It's kind of a little Plan 9 kernel that has these device files, and it logs into my machine at home, exports its own file system to that machine, and there it runs the Windows system, and it just opens DevCons, DevDraw, whatever, and like it usually does, but it's really files on my laptop that it's opening, and it doesn't know. And in slash mount term, I have my local laptop. So this is, I can deal with all my files that I have on my laptop from the machine at home running Plan 9 because it just exports the file system back home. And running Rio just opens the files and starts things. And the plumber, I wanted to get to the plumber really. So actually, let's go to maybe the kernel. So I don't know, some interesting file, maybe this one. I can click on this, like put my cursor on this file and say plum, and it will know what to do. It will open a text editor. This is not Acme, this is Sam, but it will open the file in a new text editor, and I can do the same thing here, and it will reuse the text editor that already exists. So that's quite neat, and you can also do, I don't know, if we grab for something, I don't know, I just see lock here on the screen, that's enough. I can do something like this, plum, and it will actually go to the file number you can give patterns to this plumber, and it understands what to do with those patterns and kind of does the right thing. You can also use it to open PDF files or whatever. You just click on the thing and say plum, and it will just send it somewhere that knows how to handle it. And this is pretty neat. So the fourth edition had Factotum, which is like the it's all about authentication and cryptography and so on. It handles all these protocols. And programs don't really have to implement anything of that themselves. They just talk to Factotum and they forward all the messages, and Factotum will do it. Fossil and Venti is a file system. Fossil is for, it's kind of like a cache for Venti. Venti is for archiving. It's a append only thing. But in Ninefront, those were removed because they were quite buggy at the time. And the old file server was kind of resurrected. So that is CWFS, HDFS. Ninefront got a new USB stack, a new security like key exchange protocol, because the other one was insecure. A new CPU, so CPU is like a remote login. A new CPU thing. VMX is for virtualization, so you can actually run like OpenBSD on Plan 9 as well. Lots of device drivers and many smaller fixes and improvements and so on. And as I said, 9 Legacy is like a patch set for a 4th edition. A lot of it came from Ninefront. Okay, so why didn't Plan 9, why didn't it really succeed? So compared to other operating systems, Windows had a lot of weight, like Windows NT had a lot of weight because Windows, I don't know, 3.1 was very, very popular, and people, like, it spread very quickly, and it was just very a very big operating system. Unix kind of had been along, around for a very long time, and people had gotten used to it and depended on the exact semantics of the operating system and so on. Linux got was probably successful because of the way that the development process worked, the free software style, and it also succeeded due to Unix being a re-implementation of Unix. But like, what had Pi 9 going for it? Good question. I mean, it's really nice, but maybe that just wasn't enough. And it was a research system, not a product. And the license situation was not really great until like maybe 2000 or something, which was really late. So it didn't have a lot of early adoption and not too many people contributing to it. And as a result of that, many things that we consider, that we just expect to be there, just aren't there. So like C++ or a modern web browser. So that might be a problem. But on the other side, the system is relatively pure and small and easy to grasp. But the other problem is that like Plan 9 was meant to, you have the network as the system. You don't have these monolithic Unix machines where you log in with terminals, but you build your whole system out of CPU servers, file servers, terminal machines, and so on. And that kind of it doesn't really fit with how we work with computers today, I guess. But the good things, it's a nice iteration on Unix. Many thoughts that went into Unix were really kind of polished in Plan 9, thought through to the end. Private namespaces are nice for various purposes. 9P is a very nice, easy protocol to talk over files, and it's also used elsewhere, not only in Plan 9. I think QEMU uses it. It has very nice abstractions compared to other operating systems, I think. Again, everything is a file, but this time a bit more than in Unix. Programs can really work together well on Plan 9. Unix had this pipe idea where you pipe the input of one program, the output of one program to the input of the next. And in Plan 9, this character has a stronger character like this. The code is pretty simple compared to, I don't know, Linux is huge, Plan 9 is pretty small. You can compile the whole system in like 5 minutes on a reasonably fast machine. Like kernel, user space, everything takes maybe 5 or 10 minutes. You can pretty much understand the whole system from like the boot process to, I don't know, whatever. And you can learn a lot from it. And there's still quite a lot of low-hanging fruit, I think, things to improve, things to add to it. And of course, it's fun. There's some legacy. UTF-8 was originally invented for Plan 9. I think Ken Thompson converted the whole system to Plan 9 and the whole Plan 9 system to UTF-8 in like a night or something after inventing UTF-8. The /proc file system, you know it from Linux. It came from Plan 9 or earlier Unix, actually. You have something like you have user space file systems on Linux as well. It's called Fuse there. Maybe inspired by 9P, I don't know. Private namespaces in Linux do exist, but they're not really the same. They're meant to be like they're meant to cage you in to have like separation of processes. And in Plan 9, you have it's a different idea. The reason for them being in the system is different. The Go programming language was done by pretty much the same people. Rob Pike and Thompson, Russ Cox originally did plan 9 and then use the plan 9 C compiler to bootstrap Go. And there is a user space port of a lot of the plan 9 stuff to Unix, and it was done by Ross Cox. And here are some links. There is a demo of the Blit, which is quite famous. maybe you've seen it. Plan 9 Foundation, old Bell Labs website. 9 Front 9 Legacy, and there's a lot of Unix and Plan 9 related stuff on catv.org. I don't know, I only have 5 more minutes, I think. But I already showed some demos, so I don't know if you want to see anything else or if you have questions, maybe that's the time for it now. Yes.
I read from a file. Is this just like on a normal Unix systems, or does the user space process have to speak 9P as
no.
a client?
No, no. 9P is handled like the client part of 9P is handled in the kernel. And if you have an open, like open and read system calls, this will go to the mount device in the kernel, and the mount device. Will generate the 9P messages and send them, like write them to the file or read them from the file. And the file server runs in user space. So there you actually have to implement the protocol yourself. But there's a library which facilitates it. There's still some work to do, but it's not so hard. Like you can write a simple demo file server, like some simple functionality in, I don't know, maybe 100 or 200 lines of code. Mm-hmm.
How many lines of code does the system have?
Oh, let's see. You mean everything or just the kernel?
Well, everything would be more interesting, yeah.
Oof. I don't know if I can easily do that. No. I don't know, but I think I can probably... Oops. I can tell you the kernel. So the portable part of the kernel is 70,000 lines. And the device drivers for like standard PC stuff is a bit more, but still under 200,000 lines total for a whole kernel. And then the user space, yeah, it depends. I mean, we have GhostScript for PDFs and PostScript, and that's like the main bulk of the system. Like, I don't know, 50% of the system is just GhostScript. Mm-hmm.
You said at some point that the licensing situation was a bit complicated, and I would like to know what the intention was, what Bell Labs thought they would be producing.
I think Bell Labs did not have any experience with open source or free software. I mean, the licensing situation with Unix was also complicated already, and they were just very cautious and didn't want people to use their stuff too much, I guess. They wanted to kind of make a profit, or I don't know. I can't say, but I think the way that the Unix situation played out was kind of similar, and they were just very restrictive at that time. Oh, there is a fun story. Ken actually wanted to include a lot of his music collection on the Plan 9 CDs in a new file format that they developed at Bell Labs. But the law department at Bell Labs said, nope. So we didn't get the music. Okay, that seems to be all. Okay, thank you.